Good day, everyone. Welcome to our 17th presentation on Inside the Beltway. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Mr. Fred Riesch. Please go ahead, Fred.
Hey, Kelly. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. This is Fred Riesch. I'm the chair of the Drinker-Biddle Financial Services ERISA team, meaning I'm the chair of the group that works with service providers, people that sell products and investments and services to retirement plans. And now I guess we're covering IRAs as well because of these new rules. In fact, a lot more time is probably going into IRAs than into plans. But that's my job here at the law firm. With me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad is, in addition to being a top-notch ERISA attorney doing the same kind of work I'm doing, Brad is also the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which is a fancy way of saying that Brad was Phyllis Borzy before Phyllis was. He held that very same position. Also with me is Jim Dolan. Jim is the Vice President of Retirement Strategies at NetTixis, and Jim will speak in just a second, but let me go through a few housekeeping matters first. This session is recorded. That tells you a couple of things. One, if you call in with a question, it will be recorded, which is fine. There's no problem with that, unless it would bother you. Secondly, that recording, though, will be available in a matter of days, probably early to mid next week, and it will be on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com, and there's a tab called Resources. That's where it'll be. But give it a few days. Wait till Wednesday or so. You don't even have to remember that, though, honestly, because we will then email everybody who registered for the program saying, hey, the recording has been posted, and here's a link. You should feel free to share that with others at your firm. This is we intend for this session to be as valuable as everybody as possible. Having said that, I want to turn it over to Jim. But first, I want to thank Jim and thank NetTixis for their sponsorship of these Inside the Beltway conference calls with y'all. They enable us to bring this education to you, and at this point in time, it's critically important because these new fiduciary rules and exemptions are really complicated, and they will impact almost everything you do. So Jim and NetTixis are providing an invaluable service to y'all, and we appreciate it. Jim, with that introduction, why don't you tell us a little bit?
Thanks so much, Fred. Appreciate it. We're very grateful for the partnership, and I just wanted to thank everyone for taking time out of their day today to join us in the call. We think these are very helpful. We've been doing them for several years now, so we're grateful that you're able to take the time out of your day today and join us in the call. I do want to thank Drinker-Biddle for their partnership, and I want to thank Fred Riesch and Brad Campbell for providing their great insights. I wanted to just tell you a little bit about NetTixis Global Asset Management. We're a multi-affiliate firm. We have investment solutions across fixed income, equities, and alternatives. I'd invite you to learn more about our firm and our focus on retirement by visiting our website, durableportfolios.com. And again, thanks a lot for joining us today. Fred, Brad, we're excited about the call, and I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Well, Brad, now here we are, almost to August 2016. In April, the fiduciary rule and the exemptions came out and final. They'll become applicable, generally speaking, next April 10. So we've gotten a lot of experience with what these rules mean, how they impact broker-dealers, banks, RIAs, record keepers, TPAs, on and on, the whole financial services community that deals with plans and IRAs. But that's not the whole story. There's also been some legislative efforts to overturn it. There's some litigation going on. So within that time frame, April 2016 to April 2017, can you sort of give us the overview of where we are now and of these different things that are going on, and maybe even a little idea of when we'll know something? Brad, over to you.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, thanks, Fred. And again, most importantly, thanks to all of you for in the Texas, but thanks to all of you for taking the time to join us here each quarter as we muse on these issues. It's hard to believe, really, it's been only 3 months since the rule came out because it's been an incredibly busy 3 months, I think, for all of us. But as you said, Fred, we've had a number of things happening. And in terms of the potential to affect the rule and whether we'll have to live on April 10th of next year with what DOL put out is one of the key questions. You know, you mentioned Congress. Congress has pretty much done much of what it could do. The House and Senate both passed resolutions disapproving the rule. The president vetoed those, and other than the fight over the appropriations measures for next year, in which at least the House has included so far language that would address this or is looking to do so. I forget exactly where that bill is in the process, but mostly I think we're not going to be looking to Congress to do anything in the short term that's going to affect this. The presidential election could, depending on who wins, although I have to say I think most of us don't really know what Donald Trump thinks about this rule, if anything. And we do know that Hillary Clinton's or Senator Clinton's, Secretary Clinton, whatever the right honorific there is, that their platform has endorsed the rule, so we assume it would be a continuation mostly of the current policies. In any event, the new president wouldn't take office until January 20th, so that's pretty close to April and raises issues about how much could be achieved in any event and how far down the road on compliance we'd already be. And that leaves the real wild card as the litigation. There's about 8 lawsuits that have been filed in 3 different federal district courts in Washington, D.C., in Kansas, and in Texas. And they're all procedurally a little bit different. Some have been consolidated. They're asking slightly different forms of relief. But in essence, the first hearing that's going to take place was originally going to be in Kansas in the Market Synergy case, but that's now been moved to September 21st. So now the first hearing, the oral argument, the first one is going to be in the NAFA suit in D.C., which takes place August 25th. And I think a lot of observers are assuming that because the relief that's being requested there is to do sort of stop the rule because of the irreparable harm that the plaintiffs are alleging is occurring, we are thinking that we'll probably have some sort of court ruling at least on that initial set of motions probably in September. So it may be as early as September that we hear at least one of these court cases issue at least an initial ruling. There's the cases in Texas that were consolidated. That includes the Chamber of Commerce and ACLI and a number of other trade associations. Their oral arguments are set for November 17th, so they're also a little bit in the future. So sort of throughout the fall, we'll probably be learning more about where the litigation is going. The other sort of wild card issue is, when will DOL issue guidance? We saw technical corrections that came out about a couple of weeks ago that truly were technical. They were primarily just typos and that sort of thing. In terms of interpretive guidance, I think most observers looking at this are saying, we don't see DOL issuing substantive guidance until they have a better handle on where these court cases are going. Now, we could be surprised. DOL could coordinate with the Department of Justice and put out guidance here in the near term, but I think most of us probably feel that the amount of coordination necessary to get the guidance cleared by all the relevant people in the government would be pretty extensive, and to the extent any of that guidance could be used in the litigation, we kind of think it's more likely we'll see guidance later rather than sooner. Because of the effects of the litigation. So that's my effort to do it in a short summary, but that's sort of where we are in a lot of that litigation, Fred.
Well, thanks, Brad. I think the moral of the story is that, and certainly our clients' reaction to all of this when we tell them about that, is they don't even have enough time under the current time frame to get into compliance by April 10. Therefore, they can't wait to see what the outcome of the litigation or any of these other eventualities may be. As a result, all the clients I'm working with and all the financial service companies that I hear about are working really, really hard to get into compliance by April 10. And the working assumption is that they will have to be in compliance by then. Is that what you're saying also, Brad?
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm seeing with our clients. And frankly, that's, you know, what we've been advising them is, look, we have to prepare as if the rule that we're going to comply with in April is essentially the rule that we have now. And if litigation succeeds, if Congress does something, if DOL modifies and gives us some significant relief on some sticky points, then that's great. We'll make a mid-course adjustment or stop, depending on what the outcome is. But like you said, the time is, you know, we have 9 months now roughly to compliance. And that's just not much time to turn a ship of this size. And so we need to assume that we're aiming for the target that DOL put out. Though I think all of us would you know, be open to some change if the courts were willing to grant it. So.
Well, yeah, I agree. Well, certainly the deeper we get into the weeds, the more we realize how some significant questions aren't answered and how difficult it will be to comply with some of the requirements. So some relief and some clarification both would be greatly appreciated. Well, Brad, let me turn now to the best interest contract exemption, which we call BICE or some people call BIC. All the same thing, best interest contract exemption, BICE, BIC, all the same. It's just different labels, different people put on the same thing. And we obviously can't do the whole thing. We'd have to have an 8-hour phone call to go through the whole thing. But I want to focus on advisor compensation under BICE, because that is, in many ways, the single most disruptive change in BICE and one of the hardest things for broker-dealers to figure out. Now, it could impact everybody, but it particularly impacts broker-dealers. So we'll discuss this in the context of broker-dealers. The way the rules work, the way the best interest contract exemption works, is that it says a broker-dealer, if it complies with BICE, can continue to receive variable compensation so long as the total compensation received for the services to the particular, let's say, IRA owner, is reasonable. As long as the compensation for those particular services is reasonable, as reasonable as interpreted or defined, reasonable in this context means that it is, if you have a competitive, transparent marketplace, is that the market pricing? Does the compensation of the advisor, or the broker-dealer rather, fall within the range of reasonableness? What the heck is a range of reasonableness? Well, if you have a good, open, transparent marketplace such that the market is efficient at setting pricing, and you look at a set of services, a typical set of services to an IRA, let's say an IRA invested in mutual funds with non-discretionary investment advice, and you look at what advisors and broker-dealers charge all around the country, and you make a little scattergram of that. Remember high school math, guys? We had to make scattergrams. And you create a little scattergram of that, and then you draw a circle around where the scattergram is shaded gray because there's so many dots, not black. I mean, it can be bigger than that, but gray. And you draw a circle around that. That's pretty much a working definition of the range of reasonableness. So who's in trouble? Well, it's that one advisor way off to the right on the scattergram that's totally outside the circle, and there's a clean gap between the circle and that person. That person is in trouble, or those people are in trouble under these new rules. In any event, the only thing that limits the broker-dealer from a compensation perspective is that the compensation paid to the broker-dealer by the insurance companies, the mutual funds, whoever, has to be reasonable relative to the services provided to the particular investor. And we will eventually have benchmarking reports for IRAs the way that we have benchmarking reports for retirement plans. And I have a fairly high degree of confidence that that will work itself out more easily than people think. On the other hand, when it gets to the compensation of the individual advisor, the one thing that the individual advisor's compensation cannot be based on is the commissions paid by the products. It can't be based on the front end load. It can't be based on the insurance commission. It can't be based on insurance trails. It can't be based on 12b1 fees. It can't be based on commissions on individual securities. It cannot be based, in effect, on transaction-based compensation. Instead, it's going to work out one of two ways, either a level fee or compensation to the advisor based on neutral factors. The advisor's compensation also has to be reasonable, but I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on whether it's level or it's based on neutral factors. Now, let's say that, just to make this easy, let's say a broker-dealer has three basic lines of business for IRAs. One is non-discretionary investment advice on mutual funds. Another is individual variable annuities. And the third is referrals to third-party discretionary investment managers. If that's all that advisor does, that's all the broker-dealer does, then the broker-dealer can just say, we're going to have level compensation to the advisor across all three of those lines of business, which are called, in these rules, reasonably designed investment categories. So those are new words in your lexicon, reasonably designed investment categories. So across each of these three reasonably designed investment categories, if reasonable compensation to the advisor is 1% in the first year and 25 basis points a year thereafter, that's what the advisor makes. But the pushback I get from my clients is, yeah, it's all fine and dandy legally, Fred, but those products require different amounts of effort, both initially and ongoing. Some are easier in the first year, others are harder in the first year. Some are more complex than others. They take more education on the customer. So we can't do them all equal or level because the work isn't level. And then I say, well, remember, I'm the messenger, not the message. But what BICE says is if you don't want to do it level, you can do it based on neutral factors. What are neutral factors? Well, I already told you what's not a neutral factor, and that's whatever the insurance company or mutual fund pays. That's not neutral. You can't consider that. What you can consider is the amount of work involved, the complexity of the product, how long it takes to work with the customer and explain it, maybe even the accreditations of the advisor, the experience of the advisor. It has to be factors that are not based on the fact that you sold this product versus that product. It has to be factors that are neutral as to the product or the sale. They can be based on services, the services that are provided. What would a broker-dealer do in that case? Well, they would go out, they'd hire a third-party consultant, probably. I mean, the law doesn't say they have to. They'd hire a third-party consultant because this could be the subject of a class action lawsuit. They'd want a third party because determinations made on their own might be viewed as self-serving. So they hire, in all likelihood, they would hire a third-party consultant, the bigger name, the better, and they would do an analysis, and they would say, based on neutral factors, you can, and I'm making this up now, you can pay 2% the first year for that reasonably designed investment category of individual variable annuities to the advisor. This is to the advisor now, not to the broker-dealer. 2% to the advisor the first year and 20 basis points a year thereafter. On the other hand, for the mutual fund non-discretionary investment advice reasonably designed investment category, you could pay the advisor 1% the first year because they got to get all the information and make a prudent determination and set up the asset allocation, and then maybe 30 basis points a year thereafter would be the amount of work that would be involved. I just made that up. I mean, don't pay any attention to the percentages. Just focus on the fact that they're different in the first year and they're different in the subsequent years. Then, once you're inside a reasonably designed investment category like individual variable annuities and you're paying on neutral factors, no matter which provider's individual variable annuity, and even if it's a proprietary individual variable annuity, no matter which one, the advisor gets paid exactly the same. Their compensation from one product to the other within that reasonably designed investment category cannot vary. So you've got effectively sort of level compensation, except level based on work rather than level.
Fred, if I can jump in there, I absolutely agree, and I think this is one of the least understood parts of the BIC exemption and what it allows. And I think, frankly, DOL did us quite a disservice in their initial description of this and in the fact sheets they put out, which describe the purpose of this, of the BIC exemption, as sort of preserving certain forms of traditional compensation that the rule would otherwise prohibit. And I think what people read into that is, okay, well, maybe we can still operate largely as we have been, but we're just going to have to jump through additional hoops to do so. That's not the case. The BIC exemption does not preserve the status quo with additional conditions. It still fundamentally changes the compensation arrangements that are permissible. So as you said, you may be able to find a justification to treat one, a category of investments, that reasonably designed investment category, as a separate compensation structure from another investment category. But as you said, you can't do it based on individual products within that. So, insurance company A pays more than insurance company B for an annuity. That is no longer a basis on that you can have variable compensation. You may be able to say an annuity pays more than an index fund, but not that annuity A pays more than annuity B. And so there are some real restrictions and changes even in the BIC exemption. And I still don't think a lot of people fully appreciate how limiting that's going to be and how much change that's going to represent. Let me also say just briefly, in terms of your choice there between level fee or sort of level fee within categories that you differentiate between, there's still risk in creating those differentiations. As you say, you're creating a class, there's a class action lawsuit in the offing here. Your expert says that it should be, two times the compensation for an annuity as it is for an index fund, mutual fund, because there's more work. The neutral factor of time that we've evaluated as independent experts justifies two times the compensation because it takes twice as long to explain. I'm just making up those numbers. The plaintiff's going to have an expert that says, well, that's great, but it really was 1.2 times. Let's sue about it and find out who is right. So, I mean, there's still risk in having that variable compensation at the advisor level, even after you've gotten the third-person opinion. So, there really is fundamental change going on here, and I just wanted to drill down on that because I keep hearing as I'm going out talking about the rule, people who seem to think the BIC exemption or BICE, however you want to call it, is going to let them do what they've been doing, just with more disclosure and more effort, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. That's great. I'm part of the reason I'm glad you jumped in there is because I suspect some people listening to this must think that Fred has gone entirely off his rocker. The rule can't possibly say what he just said. And because I'm running into what you said, too, where you're out delivering presentations, consulting with clients, and people are saying, oh, well, we're allowed to keep variable compensation under the rule. And what they don't understand, just to sort of drive the point home, is where the broker-dealer is allowed to keep variable compensation. The advisor is not. This rewrites the rule such that the advisor becomes agnostic as to product. In other words, no matter which product the advisor sells, the advisor is going to be compensated the same.
Within the category, just to make sure we're saying it the right way, you could still have variation from one sort of asset class to another, potentially, or a category of product to another, but not within it. So it is a very limited amount of variation at the advisor level that's permitted if you want to go down that route at all.
And there are people, I mean, if you think about the insurance companies that create individual variable annuities and manufacture them in a manner of speaking and put them out in the marketplace. If they can't compete based on the commissions they pay, what are they going to compete on? The quality of the product, the value of the wholesaling services. There's going to have to be another way to augment distribution if compensation won't be the primary way of doing it. Similarly for mutual fund companies. Maybe the wholesaling services. What value are they adding to make individual advisors' job easier, more effective, better for the customer? You all have imaginations that are every bit as good as mine. Just think about the consequences of this kind of a change in the rule, where there is no incentive to advisors to favor within a category, as Brad correctly points out, within a category, no incentive for advisors to prefer one product or another, other than to act in the best interest of the customer. So that's how that works, and it is incredibly disruptive and incredibly difficult. It's a tough job for the broker-dealers for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which, as both Brad and I have said, there's this class action litigation threat, just behind the screen. And it's there, and everybody knows it's there. It is the elephant in the room. Well, Brad, do you think we've beat up on this one good enough, or do you want to drive one more nail in the coffin?
I think we've made that one clear, and let's move on to some equally unwelcome news on something else.
Okay. Well, actually, we'll move on to welcome news. Let me juxtapose against what I just said a different situation, and this will be happening at broker-dealers, but I will use independent RIA firms as the example. For most independent RIA firms, their business model is that they provide services to an IRA owner where they manage the investments, either individual securities or ETFs or mutual funds, for a level fee. Let's just say that level fee is 1% per year. And neither the individual advisor nor the advisory firm, which I would call a supervisory entity, which these rules call a financial institution, none of them get anything more than that 1%. They don't get any benefits. They don't get any dollars. They don't get any trips or awards. They get nothing over that 1%. That is called a pure level fee fiduciary. There are no proprietary products. There's no payments from custodians. There's nothing. That's a pure level fee fiduciary. In that case, when you're providing advice to an IRA, you're not committing a prohibited transaction. You get engaged under what's called hire me, and for the moment I'm going to ignore recommendations of rollovers and recommendations to transfer IRAs from another advisor to you, but let's just say you're talking to somebody and you say, hire me. There's a thing in the fiduciary rule that says you can go out and tout your own services and say, hire me. Here are the services I provide. Here are my fees. You don't mention any products. You don't mention any particular investments or annuities or anything. You're just saying, here are the services I provide. Here are my fees. Hire me. You're not a fiduciary for doing that. That is not treated as if it were a recommendation of yourself because, as the DOL says in the preamble, you can market your own services. You can't market somebody else's services without becoming a fiduciary. There are fiduciary services without becoming a fiduciary, but you can market your own. So you say, hire me. I'll do that for 1%. I will manage on a discretionary basis ETFs inside your IRA for 1%. You're a pure level fee fiduciary. You are not committing a prohibited transaction. There is no prohibited transaction there so long as your fees are reasonable. Therefore, you do not need an exemption. Therefore, you don't have to sign the best interest contract under BICE. Therefore, you don't have to agree to the best interest standard of care. Therefore, you're only under the federal securities laws, and none of these rules we're talking about today impact you at all. That is the one area within all the services that are provided, fiduciary services, investment services provided to IRAs, that is the one area that escapes more or less untouched by these rules. So in that sense, you might say it's the favored method of providing investment advice to IRAs, not so much favored from the customer perspective, but favored from the advisor perspective in the sense that your compliance issues don't change come April 10. You just keep doing what you're doing. Keep on trucking. So, Brad, that's the pure level fee fiduciary non-prohibited transaction explanation. Do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people get confused by this because they don't understand fundamentally what DOL did with this rule. What DOL did is they changed the definition of fiduciary. So on the plan side, the ERISA plan side, that changes, that determines what your fiduciary standard of care is, and it affects the privileged transaction rules. On the IRA side, all that applies is the privileged transaction rules. So they changed the definition of fiduciary there. If you're acting in a way that's compliant with those rules already, so as Fred described, you're a pure level fee fiduciary, you have no conflicts, then the standard of care doesn't apply, because the only way DOL has to apply this best interest, which is a variation of the fiduciary standard of care, is through the exemptions that you need if you have a prohibited transaction in the IRA space. But, and here's where the other shoe drops, DOL also set it up so that almost every time you advise on a rollover or a transfer from one IRA to another or a type of account, you're going to have a built-in prohibited transaction that you're going to need an exemption for. So what Fred just described applies to your ongoing relationships to existing clients. If you have no conflicts, then the world is as it was. But if you're ever soliciting a rollover, that's when these new rules start grabbing you. So it's being a pure level fee fiduciary only helps you a little bit, frankly, under these new rules. DOL has purposely built an IRA speed bump so that every rollover, almost every rollover, results in a prohibited transaction, even if you are a level fee fiduciary. And I think a lot of people don't understand that as well.
Yeah, I agree. That tends to be an area where my clients have me focused a lot on the work I'm doing for them, the rollover issue particularly. But it does give you any IRA rollover and any IRA account that you have on April 9, 2017, if you're a pure level fee fiduciary for that account, those will roll right into these new rules without the rules impacting you. Now, the rules will impact you, as Brad just said, for capturing rollovers beginning April 10, and there is some significant responsibility there. Let me just mention one thing. Since I did get into this hire me concept, somebody wrote in with a question before the call today and said, well, in so many words, what if my standard fee for managing the, you know, Fred Reese's hypothetical mutual fund IRA account is 1% per year. But for one reason or another, maybe a competitive case, I have to go in and negotiate my fees down to 75 basis points a year. Is that okay? If you're a pure level fee fiduciary, the only restriction on your compensation under these rules is that it be no more than a reasonable amount. Now, that's not because of bias. That's because there's already a prohibited transaction rule under the Internal Revenue Code that applies to IRAs that says that you can't get more than reasonable compensation. That's effectively the Internal Revenue Code version of 408B2, and that applies to all service providers, not just to fiduciary advisors. People don't know about it because it hasn't been enforced, but it's there. So you do. Your rule is that you can't have or you can't earn more than reasonable compensation. Therefore, the greater focus would be on the 1% than on the 75 basis points, the opposite of what you might think. What I mean about that is if you're going to charge whatever the highest amount you charge is, and let's just say that's your standard fee, and let's just say that's 100 basis points, you need benchmarking data, good quality benchmarking data that just nails the fact that 1% is reasonable or less than unreasonable. If you've got really good data so that you can always defend that 1%, then yes, you can discount down from that. And there really isn't any rule on why you can, you know, what reason you have to discount down. You can discount down. The difficulty, the thing I want to warn you about, though, and the reason that I emphasized having good data about the reasonableness of the 1%, is that the minute you discount down to that 75 basis points in my hypothetical, somebody may come along and say, well, gee, if you can get the job done for 75 basis points, then 100 is unreasonable. And you need data to show that, no, 100 is reasonable. Here's my services. Here's what I charge. Here's the benchmarking data of what advisors charge around the country in similar situations. Wow, I'm reasonable. So, yes, you can do it, but remember the warning I just gave you. Brad, do you want to comment on that, or should we move on to fixed indexed annuities?
Yeah, I just want one other comment about what's a reasonable fee. I think you're right that the typical way people think of it is sort of in relation to market pricing and looking at benchmarks and scattergrams and everything you mentioned. I do think, though, you could also justify a reasonable fee by doing a, you know, actual cost accounting of your services. You know, what does it cost you to provide services? What's your profit margin? And if you're, you know, I think you can use an actual, you know, cost basis as a justification for a reasonable fee, even if that fee might be higher in relation to others. So I mean, I think there are sort of two ways to get there, but I think the market pricing is probably the most common and in some ways the easiest to usually use.
Yeah, you know, just to give you all an example of fees and value and reasonableness and all that, Brad and I and some of the other attorneys here at my firm do a tremendous amount of work for RIAs around the country, and so we draft a lot of advisory agreements for retirement plans. I will tell you the biggest difference of RIAs around the country and the services they provide to retirement plans, at least on paper. So I'm talking about the description of the services, not necessarily the quality, but on paper, the biggest difference is that some advisors provide a lot more participant services than other advisors do. By and large, everybody's plan level services pretty much look the same of the group that we work with, which tends to be a relatively specialized group, but not entirely. And so somebody provides a lot more participant services up to and including one-on-one meetings is entitled to more money than someone who only provides plan level services to the plan committee. So it not just the kind of mathematical analysis that Brad was talking about or just the benchmarking that I was talking about, but it you just keep in mind it is relative to services, and the more services and value you provide to a plan, the more you can charge for it, you know, subject to the fact that the plan fiduciaries have to be making the decision of whether or not they want those services for the plan, and they think that they're valuable relative to the cost. So it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario. And I don't want you to think that when I say benchmarking. You want to do appropriate benchmarking.
And benchmarking does have a weakness, as Fred pointed out, which is it's not an apples-to-apples comparison to what your particular advisor, for example, is doing. You know, that example of doing a bunch of meetings with participants versus relatively few, that doesn't easily translate in a lot of the benchmarks. And I know we're kind of beating this in the ground, but there is some helpful language from DOL in the preamble, and I'm blanking right now on which preamble it is, whether it's to the rule or to the BIC exemption. But it talks about reasonable fee, and it says something to the effect of, in essence, reasonableness means that the fees are not excessive in light of the total services provided. Words to that effect. That's not the exact quote, but the fees are not excessive. That is actual language in the preamble. I think that's helpful to understand that from DOL's perspective, I think people are getting really concerned about what's a reasonable fee, and I see it as two potential issues, one regulatory and one litigation. On the regulatory side, DOL has a pretty long history of viewing reasonable fees as a zone and based on the total services and not trying to nail anybody down, you know, within a couple of basis points of a particular number. DOL's always had, I think, a much more process-oriented approach. Did you evaluate what the fees were before you selected the service provider? That process could justify a range of outcomes. That's kind of how DOL's looked at it. I think the real risk there is more on the litigation side. I think that's probably where you want to make sure you have that data to back it up so that somebody else other than DOL coming in to assert that your reasonableness wasn't right, that you can point to the DOL language, you can point to your documentation, your benchmarking, et cetera, and if necessary, an explanation of why the benchmarking isn't capturing everything you're doing. With that, we've definitely beat the reasonableness horse into the ground.
I think we did. We're being perfectly unreasonable about reasonable. Brad, it's over to you now. Perhaps the single most disruptive thing that's happened in the insurance side of the equation was when the final rules came out in April, not only did the Department of Labor not move individual variable annuities back to 84-24, they doubled down and moved fixed index annuities out of 84-24 as well over into BICE. So there, I've opened the front door for you. Why don't you walk in and tell us the story?
Yeah, so the story here is that this is actually one of the specific issues that's being raised in the litigation as well, dealing with process concerns about how DOL made some of these decisions. But DOL affirmatively decided that you're going to need the BIC exemption to sell a fixed index and to advise or sell, however you want to look at it, a fixed index annuity or a variable annuity, or an individual variable annuity. But the definition of who is a financial institution who can enter into a BIC exemption, because remember the BIC contract or using the BIC exemption is between the financial institution and the client, not the advisor and the client. The definition of financial institution is limited to insurance carriers, banks, broker-dealers, and RIAs. And in the preamble, DOL explained that they knew there were other entities out there in the insurance place who handle, in particular, independent insurance agents who don't have a securities license. So typically get called IMOs or FMOs, you know, sort of intermediary marketing organizations in the insurance space. DOL said, we're not going to make them financial institutions in this exemption, but we are going to say if those entities are interested in coming and talking to us about it, they should apply for an individual exemption and we'll discuss it with them. And that has created both a need and a response. The need is there's a real question, how can an independent insurance agent who's not affiliated with a particular carrier, can they find someone able to be a financial institution for them? Because there's some question as to whether insurance carriers are going to be willing to take responsibility and supervisory responsibility for agents who aren't, you know, who are independent of the carrier. And so a number of FMOs and IMOs have applied to the Department of Labor seeking an exemption to allow them to be financial institutions for this purpose. So that process is ongoing. DOL is reviewing those applications, and we're waiting to see, you know, where that's going to go. But that's sort of a hole in the regulatory scheme here that there's several different approaches to fixing. One is the litigation pointing out the hole, raising questions about it. Another is DOL's method of applying to get the status and explaining to DOL why it should be granted. And the question is, will DOL agree? And we don't know the answers to those yet. But this is very much an active issue, and it's going to be pretty important in the fixed index annuity space and the variable annuity space, because it really is a fundamental question. Who's going to be a financial institution able to enter into a BIC arrangement, a best interest contract, to sell or advise on these products?
Yeah, a couple of additional thoughts on it. There have been 6 applications filed with the Department of Labor by entities that want to be financial institutions for the purpose of distributing fixed index annuities. Brad, me, and Bruce Ashton, with the help of a couple other attorneys here, have filed 4 of those 6. So in theory, mathematically, we have 2/3 of the institutional knowledge in the country about how that process works and what needs to be in the filings.
Let the record show that was Fred's comment, not mine.
Okay. Well, you have institutional knowledge, too. Well, we're working very, very actively on that, and I think that the Department of Labor has been receptive. They're engaged in serious conversations on that, and that in due course exemptions will be forthcoming, because this is the one area where that concept of having a financial institution supervise the implementation of the best interest contract exemption has just fallen apart. As a practical matter, there is a real need for financial institutions for that area. So we see a solution coming down the line. Apparently, independent insurance agents are a significant amount of or significant players in the distribution process for those annuities, and it would be just extraordinarily disruptive of the marketplace if there weren't a solution. Moving on to the next subject, Brad, you introduced, and then we're going to go to Q&As in just a couple minutes, but be thinking about what questions you want to ask. Brad, the next subject is distributions and rollovers. And let's focus on the level fee fiduciary and the requirements for a level fee fiduciary to comply. And I think there are probably two aspects to this discussion. One is, what the heck is a level fee fiduciary, which might surprise you. It appears that it's a little different than what we call the pure level fee fiduciary, at least in some regards. And then secondly, since we think that non-level fee fiduciaries, in other words, just advisors who maybe with broker-dealers that receive 12b-1 fees or revenue sharing or whatever, are going to have to, in addition to satisfying all the other BIC requirements, they're also going to have to satisfy, we think, because it's not clear, the same requirements as the level fee fiduciary. With that in mind, Brad, why don't you talk a little bit about what a level fee fiduciary is?
Yeah, so again, this gets confusing because we keep using very similar terms to refer to different things, and that's partly a function of just how DOL labeled it. So, you know, Fred was talking before about being a pure level fee fiduciary. In other words, you're somebody who is only getting paid a fee for that. You don't have any affiliates or anyone else who's making any money in connection with your advice. That is somewhat similar to the concept that's going on in this level fee option in the BIC exemption. And basically the notion is that if the fee that you've disclosed to the client that you're going to charge them for advice is the only compensation that's going to be received in connection with the advice, then this level fee option gives you a much easier way in terms of paperwork and burden and no contracts and everything to have an exemption allowing you to do a rollover. You know, I said before that a lot of people still, I think, haven't understood that almost every rollover advice is also a prohibited transaction. And the reason for that is the DOL has taken the view that, and when they made rollover advice fiduciary advice, they've taken the view that if you tell someone not just where to go with the money, but just whether they should do a rollover, that what you're really telling them is that they should liquidate the assets that are in their 401k account, and therefore that is advice about those assets, therefore it's fiduciary, and it's a prohibited transaction because you're either getting paid something different than you are as an advisor to the plan when you get them in an IRA, or you're getting paid something new because you were getting zero before when you were telling someone, it's a cold call situation. You were getting nothing before. Now you're getting something. Either way, your fiduciary advice to liquidate that account is causing you to receive a fee. So it's almost always a prohibited transaction, even if you are a level fee advisor in other respects. But this level fee option in the BIC exemption is intended to say, but if you're a level fee advisor otherwise, and really the only prohibited transaction we're facing here is this rollover event, then we DOL are giving you an expedited process that's much simpler in compliance to permit you to do the transaction despite that prohibited transaction. And in essence, it boils down to a couple of requirements. You have to adhere to the impartial conduct standards, which is that you're a written acknowledgement of fiduciary status, charging only reasonable fees, making no materially misleading statements. And you have to adhere to the best interest standard, which is essentially the fiduciary conduct standard in all the exemptions. And in the case of advice about type of account or rollovers, you have to produce a written explanation, which, frankly, I think you would have to do anyway to comply with your normal fiduciary obligations under this new rule. And I think that's probably what Fred was alluding to when he was saying a lot of these requirements end up being similar. But you have to produce a written explanation of why this transaction is in their best interest. And I think that documentation and that judgment about what information do I need to decide that this is in their best interest, what are the relevant factors to that advice, how do I document that I asked those questions, gathered that data, and that I sort of appropriately considered it in reaching the conclusion that this is or is not in your best interest to do a rollover. I think that's where a lot of the action on this exemption is going to need to focus. What is the process? What's the documentation? How do we demonstrate that we actually did do all the work to show that this was in the best interest? Fred, what do you think?
No, I agree. I would add two things. One, as a fiduciary, under the general fiduciary rules, the advisor has a duty to investigate. In other words, you can't just say, gee, it sort of seems this way. I'll make a best interest determination on that basis. You have to get the comparative data that's required and you have to analyze it, and then only then can you make an informed and reasoned recommendation, in other words, a prudent recommendation. Secondly, some of the questions and discussions that I've been involved in lately about this, I think there is some general agreement that you cannot recommend 100% of the time that people roll over. I would guess if you have a large enough database of decisions, not 100% of them could be rollover recommendations, because there will be some cases where it will likely be in the best interest of the retirement investor, of the participant, to stay in the plan. And maybe better stated, I should have said, there is a risk if you've recommended 100% of the time that people roll over, that a plaintiff's attorney or a claimant's attorney could say that indicates that the process was not robust enough, because there are some plans that have such good investments, such low costs, and such good services that the advisor would reasonably recommend that the person stay on the plan. So those are my parting thoughts. Why don't we open it up to questions?
Let me just add one last thought before we do that, which is there are, of course, going to be times when the participant says to you, you recommended them, you know what, your plan actually is really good, you should stay there. And the participant says, I don't care, I hate my boss, I hate my plan, I want nothing to do with these people, I'm retiring and this is the end. You can follow that direction. You've given them advice. I would like you to document that they chose not to follow your advice and directed you to do something else. But just because you tell them the rollover's not in their best interest doesn't mean that you can't do one for them if they say, but I want it anyway. And I think that's an important distinction to remember.
Yeah, and that comes up in our discussions with clients as well, that what I was talking about was the advisor's recommendation. This is still the investor's money, and the investor still gets to decide what to do with it. In talking with clients about what Brad said, there is a serious concern about how to document and supervise that, because what happens if they say, if it's an advisor at a broker-dealer and this particular advisor keeps sending letters to the broker-dealer saying, from the customer signed almost like a form letter saying, notwithstanding your good advice, I've decided to roll over, and they just get letter after letter after letter like that. Does that indicate that the advisor is not engaging in the process as seriously as they should, and the advisor is just going to this letter approach by encouraging the participants to override the recommendation? So it's not easy, but from a legal perspective, Brad's answer is perfectly correct. Yes, it's the investor's money. What you need to do is figure out how to manage that risk that I just pointed out. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, sir. At this time, if you would like to open it up for questions, you may press star 1.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Again, that will be star 1 for questions, and a voice prompt will indicate once your line has been opened.
Would you repeat that one more time, Kelly? I interrupted you partway through.
Of course. It is star 1 for questions. We'll go first to Mary Claire Voss.
Yes.
Hi, Fred. I was just wondering if on the last topic on rollovers, are you hearing that firms are going to try and stick to education only, or going to try and do everything you just said about documenting and having a process?
I don't think people have coalesced yet. I mean, some people are saying they're going to go the education approach. Other people are saying that no, their advisors are used to making recommendations. They're going to have to figure out a way to use the recommendation approach. From my perspective, there are three different ways that a rollover could be captured. One is unsolicited. The investor goes to the advisor and says, you've been handling my personal money for years. I like the way you do it. I'm retiring. I'm going to roll over with you. Well, you don't need an education. You don't need recommendation. The decision's already been made. You just, from a risk management perspective, you need to document that that's, in fact, what happened. A second way is education, and we're building out educational materials for people. I mean, the most obvious group that will use education are the call centers for broker-dealers, call centers for particularly for 401k record keepers. Because their conversations are tape recorded. The quality of the education they provide has to be exceptional because of that and for other reasons. So they're going to go certainly, at least as far as I can tell, the education route. And then the third one is recommendation. And that's another word for that is the fiduciary route. I think people are in the process of making the decisions. I don't think final decisions have been made yet. I do believe that tools are going to be built out that will support recommendations, and as a part of that, that the number of RIA firms and broker dealers allowing recommendation will probably be larger than we might expect.
Yeah, I would just add, too, that I think for a lot of service providers of various sorts, it's going to probably end up being a blended approach where certain contacts, like let's say the initial call screening center, is strictly education only, but there might be the ability to refer someone to someone who's able to give the fiduciary solution as well. So I think we might see layers of approach depending on how the business is coming in and what the question is.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hello.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Interested in variable compensation with regard to categories that you mentioned, like variable annuities or mutual funds. On a typical growth fund, there may be breakpoints where if you hit the low breakpoint, you may receive 5% comp to the broker-dealer. In other situations, maybe it's just 0.5%. How do you suggest broker-dealers manage that with regard to paying out a level comp to the advisor?
Brad, why don't you jump in and...
Let me make sure I understand. Are you talking about sort of a tiered pricing where the fee depends on the volume of assets that are invested, or are you talking about where the actual advisor compensation overall depends on gross asset accumulations or amount of business placed with a particular provider?
No, I'm just talking about an individual transaction where client A may have $10,000 and that's placed in a mutual fund and the comp to the broker-dealer is 5% versus a larger client that invests $1 million and the compensation is just 50 basis points to the broker-dealer.
I think tiered pricing, which is kind of how I think of that. In other words, that we charge a fee for a certain way up to a certain amount and then a different fee above that, doesn't run afoul of this because that really is in essence a neutral pricing that reflects the amount of work and sort of the what's a reasonable fee in connection with those assets. I mean, at a certain point, you're not adding a whole lot of extra work, even though there's a lot more assets, so it makes sense that the fee doesn't just go up in a straight line forever, and it costs, you know, $500,000 to get advice over a large amount of money compared to, you know, $5,000 for advice over a smaller amount. So I think that kind of tiered pricing can work within those categories because it's not based on sort of an incentive comp to the advisor. It's really just based on what's a reasonable fee in connection with providing the service to an account of size A versus an account of size B. I don't know. What do you think, Fred?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on how it's put together, how the program is established. For example, if we're talking about the classic RIA model, we'll charge 1% on the first 100,000, 0.9 on the next 150,000, and so on. That's fine, and that's assuming there's no compensation being paid to the advisory firm or the broker dealer, no proprietary products, no other money. Then you can just split that with the individual advisor. However, but if I understand the question, we're more under a buy scenario. Where the broker-dealer may be getting 12b-1 fees and other payments from individual insurance companies or mutual fund complexes. the amount that the broker-dealer makes cannot be taken into account. That is not one of the factors that you can consider in compensating the advisor. So can you compensate the advisor on break points? Yeah, sure, but not based on compensation received by the broker-dealer from products. So you'd really have to get down the weeds a little bit further in that scenario to understand it. But let's say advice on individual variable annuities is a reasonably designed investment category. Then what you'd say is no matter which variable annuity you, the advisor, sell, you will get 1% on the first $250,000 of deposits, 75 basis points on the next $250,000 of deposits. That would be fine because you're paying, assuming that is reflective of the work and supported by neutral factors, you could have that kind of a scale. And as Brad said, those scales make sense because a certain amount of the work is a fixed cost, and maybe as the size go up, the work becomes more, variable, but not dollar for dollar variable. So you could have a tiered compensation schedule for the advisor based on neutral factors. In fact, I think that's coming. I think that if you look at what's happened in the 401k world, we've had pricing, the larger a plan gets, the lower the percentage paid to the advisory firm and the advisor gets. So I think we're going to have to go more to that kind of a, tiered basis for compensating firms and advisors. Operator, we have time for one more question, then we're going to have to call it a day.
Okay. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi. I had a question, if you can hear me, regarding the variable compensation that the broker-dealer can accept. And I struggle with that because the services provided by the broker-dealer, let's use mutual funds, for example, if the broker-dealer has 300 mutual funds on its platform at the firm level, which is where the best interest contract lies, the services are the same for all 300 funds, yet the funds are paying different compensation to the broker. So how does the broker justify that? It's in the best interest of its clients and avoid conflicts.
Well, I mean, you start off with the rule, which says the rule is that the broker-dealer can receive no more than reasonable compensation. And I don't think it's ever going to come down to a few basis points this way or the other. These lines just are not that finely drawn. But there is going to have to be some assessment of in that situation for the services provided, more or less, what is the typical compensation of a broker-dealer. Now, I'm being a little overly simplistic by saying typical because the DOL does say in the preamble that customary is not necessarily prudent. But I think they're referring to a situation where in fact, they go on to say that at least one example of that would be where some of the fees are hidden and not adequately disclosed to the investors. So if you have hidden fees, the risk of unreasonable compensation, at least based on that language, is much higher, and I'm sure a plaintiff's attorney would point to that. On the other hand, if you're pretty much fully transparent and other broker-dealers are fully transparent and the information is that in a competitive marketplace, that's where the market prices those services. Even if it varies from mutual fund to mutual fund, then that would be okay.
I know that's what the rule says, but, I mean, the firm definitely has an interest in selling those funds that pay the firm more money, and the FAs of that firm know it, because it's publicly disclosed on the website. And so I think there's a built-in conflict that the DOL has just been willing to accept. Is that right?
I think you put it very well. What DOL probably meant when they said the BIC exemption preserves certain forms of traditional compensation is that they kind of viewed it as the big give we're letting you have here is we're going to let the institution continue to get more or less the similar type of unlevel compensation it's gotten in the past. But we're going to draw a line in the sand where they have to make sure that that conflict doesn't seep over to the advisors. And so your compensation of your advisors has to make sure that it isn't affected by the money that the institution's getting, which is variable. Now, as you say, in practice, is that a litigation risk you want to take? That's a different question than does the exemption permit the institution to receive and keep the variable compensation? The exemption clearly does. The other one is one of those business risk versus legal judgment questions that each company is going to have to basically sort out for itself and decide where it wants to be on that spectrum. But, yeah, as Fred said, within the constraints of reasonable fee and a few other requirements, and in particular, making sure the advisors are insulated from the conflict by virtue of having policies and procedures and compensation structures that don't let it seep through, then it is okay under the exemption.
Thank you.
Two thoughts on that, two additional thoughts. One is, if there's a claim or a lawsuit, the claimant's attorney or the plaintiff's attorney will get your policies and procedures and will, unless they're incredibly good, will challenge that they weren't robust enough to protect the influence, to protect the firm from influencing the advisor. And of course, how those policies and procedures are supervised would be a matter at risk. Your training materials would be an issue they'd look at and so on. So you need something pretty good in place internally. The second is, though, think about the advisor's position. In many cases, the advisor is going to be, well, in all cases, the advisor is going to be getting flat compensation. Maybe not by April 10, but a year or two or three from now, the advisor is going to figure out, well, gee, if I'm charging 150 basis points, I and the firm are charging 150 basis points for managing mutual funds for this this IRA owner. I'm better off using mutual funds with an expense ratio of 40 basis points than I am of using mutual funds with an expense ratio of 100 basis points. I'll produce a better return and a happier client. And I get the same amount of money. So I think there's going to be some... I think the best interest standard of care, which says that you have to take cost into account in making recommendations, and the practical effect of these rules is being underestimated right now. I think that it's going to take 4 or 5 years to fully work its way through the system, but more expensive investments will be disfavored and less expensive investments will be favored. Just by how all this works, independent
right.
of the rules. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You betcha. Well, everybody, I'm going to turn the program back to Jim. He's got a couple of announcements that I think you want to hang on and hear about. Jim, go ahead.
Thanks, Fred, and thank you again to everyone for joining us on the call today, and thank you to Drinker Biddle, and thank you, Brad Campbell, for joining us. We really appreciate the partnership and hope you found today's call insightful and helpful. Please mark your calendars for October 13th. That will be the fourth quarter call, so hope everyone has a wonderful summer, and thank you for joining us today. And Kelly, please close up the call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, that will conclude today's conference, and we do thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, everybody.